Never in the history of insurance has insurance itself prevented the loss. It's all about having more resilience in the event that a loss occurs. And so that sort of like, you know, we should only promote security and insurance has no place here, it's really kind of missing the point. Because if you think about any other type of risk, there's this really, really useful and productive feedback loop of losses happen.
Do you want to hear about the latest developments in the cyber market and learn best practices and thought leadership from cyber insurance and security experts? We talk all things cyber insurance industry, international growth, cyber claims, and more. Welcome to the Cybersecurity and Insurance Leaders Podcast.
Hello, Sarah. Welcome to the Sarah Show for cyber insurance and security leaders. Yeah, really, really excited to have you on.
Excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Cool. So yeah, I guess we'll just jump right into it. You know, what can you tell me about your company and your team? What is it that you do?
So my name is Sarah Stevens. I'm the cyber practice leader at Marsh here in London. And so what does that really mean? That means that we have a whole load of insurance brokers and risk advisors who are talking to companies in the UK about their cyber risk, about how insurance works, about if it makes sense for them, how to buy it, and then we help them kind of through that whole process. Equally, London being a vibrant and innovative insurance hub, we've got a whole team of people who are helping clients to come to the London market and buy insurance from mostly Lloyd's, but also company markets here. And so we see weird and wonderful risks and interesting issues from all over the world. And it's really fun. And then my sort of secondary role is that I have responsibility for the regional cyber practices for Marsh outside of the U.S. and Canada.
Okay. So basically it's everything outside North America then in terms of geographies or what you're focused on?
Yeah, that's right.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I guess it makes a lot of sense being aligned with Lloyd's as well. You know, being in the same city, you know, with Lloyd's, you've got such an international presence.
Yeah, totally. Like,
one of the things I find really interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and I like the magic of the London market. You know, I'm an American. Mm-hmm. I've been here for almost 10 years, and I still find it's just so cool that you're walking down the street and you see somebody that you wouldn't have thought to set up a meeting with, mm-hmm. but then you literally bump into them, and you're having a conversation about something, or you see them in a coffee shop or a pub, so that in-person interaction is not dead. In fact, I think it leads to more innovative thinking. It leads to more creativity coming out of this, you know, this little hub here.
Yeah, absolutely. I love it. I talk to people all the time. It's fun. You can just, you know, if you don't have any meetings booked, just walk around the city and, you know, you'll get a meeting in there.
Totally.
Run into somebody.
Yeah. They did change. You know, there was a hub underneath Lloyd's, and now it's, you know, now it's only a coffee shop. So different sort of interactions, but still a lot of fun.
True. So just in terms of size of clients then, you know, what do you really focus on?
So I think that our bread and butter and where we're the strongest is in the large risk managed client space. But, you know, we find companies of every size have cyber risk needs. And just because a company is smaller doesn't mean that they, you know, they need less help or their issues are any less complex. But it does mean that we have to come up with different service models to help them efficiently.
Okay. So just in terms of your company strength then, you know, what is it when it comes to cyber?
I think that especially in the, you know, what is now the first hard market that the cyber insurance market has experienced in its, you know, whatever you want to say, 20, 25 years of being a thing. Our strength has been, look, there is difficulty and hardship ahead, clients, and the market is going to be really tough. But we're going to be totally honest with you and upfront about what you're going to experience. And we have a process which is going to help you get through that market and be able to direct your results as much as you possibly can to give you that sense of control back. And we're going to guide you through that in the most efficient and effective way. That's what's really resonated with our clients over the last few months. I think generally also we have a reputation as, you know, thorough, knowledgeable, and really client focused.
Okay. Great. So I guess transitioning a bit into, you know, some of the things we've been talking about, you know, cyber insurance versus cybersecurity. You know, obviously I come from the cybersecurity world, having moved into insurance. And so it's, you know, it's kind of interesting for me kind of looking at one versus the other. You know, what are your thoughts on that? Cyber insurance versus cybersecurity?
Yeah, I mean, one of my pet peeves, I think, in the journalism that surrounds cybersecurity is, you know, you see people say things like, you know, either you spend money on security or insurance, or like insurance is useless because it doesn't prevent a loss, which is just like kind of a ridiculous thing to say. Never in the history of insurance has insurance itself prevented the loss. It's all about having more resilience in the event that a loss occurs. And so that sort of like, you know, we should only promote security and insurance has no place here. Mm-hmm. It's really kind of missing the point, because if you think about any other type of risk, there's this really, really useful and productive feedback loop of losses happen, and because insurers are there to take them on, they're learning what things did you do that prevented a loss? What things did this company do that, you know, allowed a loss to occur? And so you have that input, and in a healthy sort of risk feedback loop, that input goes from insurers back to insureds in the form of both carrots and sticks. You know, your premium will go down, or you'll get broader coverage if you do these things, or, you know, if you don't do these things, your price will go up, or you'll become uninsurable. And so to think of that as like some binary decision of either you manage the risk or you buy insurance is just totally crazy, and seems, you know, it seems unique to this phase in the historical development of cyber insurance, because it's still maybe, you know, still a newer thing. It's still not, you know, especially outside the U.S., still not got really wide adoption. I think we would estimate that fewer than 50% of companies worldwide buy cyber insurance. So there's loads that still don't have that in place and therefore aren't seeing that useful feedback loop. So that, I think is, you know, it's a weird distinction of insurance versus security, because really they have to go hand in hand.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. I think it's, it is interesting to see how they interact in that way. And I guess sort of maybe not too dissimilar, you know, what is kind of something out there that you see either in cybersecurity or cyber insurance that you really disagree with?
I think one of the things that is like sort of, you know, broken is maybe a strong word, but I think one of the key issues that that exists is everyone's doing business with lots of other parties. And we, you know, outsourcing is not a new thing. And like everyone's got tons of components to their technology supply chain or third parties that they're working with. And I think that process of third party security assurance is, you know, it really becomes an exercise in tick boxes and checklists. And in some senses, you could say the same for cyber risk underwriting in an insurance context. But doing that like by checklist, or simply by, you know, you have to fill out my questionnaire and computer says no if you don't say yes to this question, I think that really misses the point. But equally, like, you can't necessarily have a, you know, super person hour intense exercise of, you know, let me really understand every single third party that I'm working with and getting under the skin. So, you know, I don't know what the solution to that is, if it's more automation, more sort of trust marks around particular components of cybersecurity, but I really disagree with that practice of, you know, we just have a list and we have to check the boxes and then we move on, because it doesn't allow for nuance or creativity or for, you know, real understanding of risk.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's one of the things I found interesting about insurance is I think it gives a really practical way to do that. You know, my previous experience has been, you know, you have these really massive risk exercises. I always thought insurance was quite good at boiling it down to, you know, kind of more specific things.
Kind of like here's the stuff that we really, really care about. And well, you know, and like, that's kind of one of the problems that's happened right now in this hard market is I think in prior years in the cyber insurance market, we could have a sensible conversation between a client, an underwriter, and a broker about what are the key things you really care about, what's important. And I think in some ways, because of the losses that have happened over the last few years, underwriters in some sense have been forced to show that they're doing more due diligence and that they're asking, you know, a load of questions. But I think even for them, sometimes those questions aren't always getting to the heart of how does this client manage the risk? Do I trust them to have agility in the face of a dynamic threat or not? And that's been lost somewhat. And I don't really blame underwriters themselves. Sometimes it's just, you know, the capital management at that firm, you know, has to demand more stringent underwriting criteria. And so it's like where an underwriter might want to take a more sensible approach or to really understand, can I trust the management of this firm to do the right thing in the face of this threat? Instead, they have to ask, you know, did you install this software on this, in this part of your organization? And I think that goes back to kind of like being a tick box exercise versus one of true trust.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess one of the things we've seen a lot of is being one of the things that insurance, you know, has really pointed out as being something that helps a lot are tabletop exercises, you know, just kind of getting down and really practicing, you know, what you do in an incident, which you've kind of, you know, quickly touched on, in your last, statement, but, you know, how important are they really? What are your thoughts on that?
I think they're super important. And I think, you know, where they're really effective is where you really stress everyone out. I mean, I think like, cause I've attended some in the past where it's like, okay, we're having this tabletop exercise. Great. And, you know, we have a third party who's organizing it and, you know, you show up and everyone sits around a table and it's like, okay, so this happened, you know, you need to, notify your customers of this big data breach you've had, you know, what would you do? And instead of talking about making decisions about what you do or really being under any pressure to debate, okay, this is what we'd have to do. And then like, let's choose something and then let's grade ourselves later in the debrief about how that went. It's like, let's just discuss how we might go about that. And yeah, we'd have to consider that. Yep. We should probably talk to legal. Yeah. Maybe we should think about drafting something. And it doesn't put you under the pressure that it really would take to evaluate how good am I going to be in the real situation. And I think a lot of companies then, have similar conversations around ransomware and would we pay a ransom, which is an incredibly fact specific, determination. And obviously, you know, every situation is a little bit different, but I've also observed sometimes the sort of knee jerk before the incident reaction is we would never pay. So we don't have to talk about this. And what we've observed then in real situations is that it's often a much more nuanced decision process. But if you haven't really put yourself under pressure to test your response, you might not know how to get better before it's too late.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I think it definitely makes a difference having the realism. I think the more incidents you go through, you know, you realize you're never going to be able to have a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But as you go through it a lot, you tend to stay calm, level headed and be able to more easily, like you mentioned, the paying the ransom question, I think is a really good one to really dig into in one of these tabletops.
Yeah. You know, and you don't have to come up with like your perfect response, but the act of having to make the decision on the spot in front of your peers and then to say, all right, maybe we should have thought about that differently in a debrief. It just helps everyone to be more prepared for the real thing.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess, you know, another thing that's really thought of is coming out of the insurance world or being something very common in insurance is really getting down to quantifying the risk. You know, why is that important? What do you see when it comes to quantifying risk?
I do see that sometimes we over focus on how correct we can be about quantifying the risk. So rather than accepting that we're going to be directionally accurate and we're going to be able to say, you know, your risk is closer to 100 million than it is to 500 million or, you know, whatever that is. We sometimes worry that we can't say that your risk is 107.3. And so because of a feeling that cyber risk quantification isn't accurate enough, we decide not to do it at all. And by, you know, by we, I mean like sometimes some clients, so, you know, or, you know, even, you know, those that are advising clients, sometimes it feels like it can't be correct because we, you know, don't have enough data or it's not been around long enough or we can't get the right information. Nothing is credible. You know, I think sometimes that's a temptation to simply not do it. But actually, that directionally accurate information about it's 100 million, not 500, allows you still to make decisions about how you treat that risk. And so I think it's so important to still go through that exercise and to understand what your risk looks like, how big is it, and therefore how do you make decisions about how to allocate capital? Because one of the things we observe is that the information that boards often get from companies is about cybersecurity is not about, it's not translated into the language of a board. It's not translated into dollars or pounds or whatever. It is about security metrics. So it's, we prevented, you know, our phishing test click-through rate got down to 3%. And isn't that great because it's an improvement over last quarter? And if I'm a board member, I'm sort of like, okay, that sounds good, right? But what do I do about that? But if we say we've done all of these things and we therefore believe that the size of our cyber risk has reduced from X to Y, and therefore we recommend we spend this much money on these security tools, which we think will have this impact, and we spend this money on insurance, which will mitigate the residual risk, that gives such a clearer picture that people at a board level can use to approve decisions or allocate budget versus we did all this great security stuff and, you know, it's really good. So I think that that's the importance of quantification, is being able to get to how a company really spends money in an intelligent way. And I think the other thing about quantification that's really important to think about is that it's not one and done. So you can't quantify your cyber risk today in, you know, June 2022, and then it's done for the next 5 years. It has to also be something we accept is an ongoing process because it's a dynamic threat. And we know that not only is the ability to get precision on modeling so that we can make good decisions going to get better and better and better, we also know that it's a risk where the threat is constantly evolving. And so, you know, as we've seen in the last few years with ransomware losses, that has changed really significantly. What do we think your maximum probable loss resulting from a ransomware incident is today is a totally different calculation than it was 5 years ago. And that doesn't mean we were wrong 5 years ago. That means that criminals evolved the way that they behave. And so we have to continually think about this as a bit of a moving feast. And that can be a very uncomfortable thing to accept, but we have to live in that discomfort and that dynamic space.
So have, as you're just talking a bit about risk quantification and the size of the cyber risk, you know, that people are facing. Have you seen, you know, what have you seen in terms of limits? Are people trying to get more limits? Obviously, we talk a lot about the hard market and the challenges in getting what you want, but are clients really, really aware and pushing for more? Do they see it as a larger risk?
Almost universally, we see clients seeking more limit than the market has available today. And yeah, so typically the restriction, any restriction on or reduction in the amount of limits that a client purchases right now in the last year, what we've mostly observed has been clients reducing limits either because of budget constraints or because of capacity availability, but more likely because of a lack of availability.
Okay, interesting. So I guess shifting gears a little bit, you know, just in your role, you know, what things are the most important to you?
I think the client experience and helping our clients to be able to simplify and understand what cyber risk is, demystify it a little bit, and then to have a good experience approaching the insurance market, or if they decide not to approach the insurance market, how can we help them to become more secure, to be better prepared to have an incident, to help them if they do have that incident. I think the most important thing to me is to make sure that we are an advocate for what our clients need, and that we are shepherding them through the processes that we need to go through in a way that is focused on all the challenges they have. And often those challenges include trying to wrangle multiple stakeholders within an organization, sometimes trying to fight an uphill battle, sometimes trying to sell the value of buying a type of insurance which has not been all that consistent in pricing or terms or conditions in the last 2 or 3 years. And so I think to have that, you know, it's really important that we have that empathy for our clients and that we're constantly advocating for what they need. And that, of course, can be difficult being in the middle of the transaction, because we also understand and empathize underwriters need to get the information that they need to, you know, kind of correct the pricing in their books. And ultimately with the goal, not of, you know, how can we make the most money in this short period of time, I hope, but instead to have a sustainable book of business that is there for the future for our clients. So we're concerned about how we can make all that happen.
Okay. Interesting. And I guess, yeah, I guess just looking at current events then, you know, what's something that you find intriguing in cyber right now?
I think a lot of our clients have, you know, of course, have asked us a lot of questions about the impact of the conflict in Ukraine and the, you know, the possibility of the Armageddon of Russian cyber attacks. And I think, you know, what we have seen is actually that's not occurred. And one hypothesis is, of course, that that companies over the last few years, especially as they've faced an epidemic of ransomware, have hardened themselves against attacks and have become more secure, better able to respond and or prevent and detect attacks. So I think that's been a huge topic of conversation with clients in recent months. I think looking forward, one of the most interesting topics that is more related to cyber insurance is how can we get more capital into the market when insurers are largely worried about this specter of, you know, everyone says systemic or, you know, correlated risk. When everyone is worried about how we're going to deal with correlated risk and will a catastrophic cyber event, you know, take down my book and therefore mean that I can't write cyber risk anymore, I think that's going to be really interesting in the next 6 to 12 months as the market starts to, well, continues to grapple with that issue. So, you know, we think a lot about that. Of course, from a client's perspective, you know, the way that an insurer deals with that issue in an individual client's policy has to be clear. It can't simply be if something really big and bad happens, then it's not covered anymore. If you have a widespread event that occurs, then suddenly a sublimit applies to your policy, and I'll know it when I see it, and I'll tell you if that's happened. We are really, really We have to advocate for total clarity for a client. So we have to understand what does a catastrophic cloud outage mean and how do you define that in an individual policy. So I think there are tactics that insurers can use to manage that risk, which translate to wording in an individual client's policy, but there are also tactics that they can use in managing their overall portfolio and using reinsurance. And so there has to be a good balance of those techniques to deal with that risk, because if a client doesn't have clarity about when my policy will pay versus when it won't pay, they'll just stop buying it entirely.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. I think we've gone past the stage where people don't believe it's going to pay when it comes to cyber policy. For the most part, be surprised some of the things you see in the security press. But I think, implementing really unclear and widespread sort of aggregation exclusions would probably scare a lot of people. Yeah. They don't understand it. So I guess shifting gears again from kind of talking about the industry and maybe just some quick closing questions. How did you originally get into insurance?
My lights have gone off.
There we go. They're back.
We're back. I just needed to move a little bit. I wanted no part of being in insurance. I come from an insurance family. And so my parents owned a small insurance agency in Indianapolis, Indiana. And then my dad worked in insurance his entire career. So I thought that sounds really boring and I don't want to do any of it. And, I interviewed for jobs in 2002, and the one, good offer that I had was from an insurance broker. So that's where I ended up. And it's like inevitable. I think when you come from an insurance family that you might end up working in insurance. And, that's kind of how I got into it. And then I accidentally got into cyber as a niche within the insurance industry because I thought I was applying for a D&O broker position. And it turned out it was in this new team that did technology and professional risks. And it wasn't actually a D&O team. And I was like, well, that sounds cool. Like, would you like to hire me? And I did. And that was that. That was 2006.
Okay. Yeah. It's funny. There's some parallels there. I maybe not quite in engineering family, but I started with engineering and then sort of came out at the .com boom and sort of somehow ended up drifting out. It's like, well, there's a lot of jobs over there. There's not a lot of jobs over here. I think I'll go over there. And that was the beginning of sort of technology and then stumbling into cyber as well, some years in because I had some similar background, but I didn't actually start out as a cyber security person, much less a cyber insurance one. Insurance was an accident too, by the way.
I feel like a lot of security, people with true security credentials that end up in cyber insurance. They're like, I didn't know you were all here. Oh, hello. Yeah.
Well, for me,
wow, we all talk about the same stuff.
I can't remember if we've talked about this, but it was more than 8 years ago now. And I still remember the first time I saw cyber insurance and started working with cyber insurers. I thought that's a really silly idea. Nobody wants to buy insurance for that. That doesn't make any sense. And then here I am 8 years later thinking it's the greatest thing ever. Yeah. More than 8 years. So it is funny how it ends up working out. What is that? That's a strange thing. So what do you recommend to anyone who wants to have a successful career in the insurance industry?
Listen more than you talk and try to remember that, understanding risk is not something that we invented in the cyber insurance, little niche of the industry. Like we didn't invent insurance and cyber insurance is still insurance. So, getting back to focusing on what does a company do? How do they make money? what could go wrong if, you know, things don't work, like going back to those first principles and really listening to clients and when they describe their business to you, taking that on board and not skipping ahead to, yeah, but do you have MFA? I think that would be, you know, like anybody who's starting out in cyber insurance, we sometimes, I think, lose sight of understanding our clients' businesses and listening first. So that is, and as long as you do that and you always have clients' best interests at heart and their needs, you know, in front of mind as you're advocating for them, then I think you can really not go wrong.
Okay. Thanks for that. I think always good advice. You've got an opportunity to directly address our audience. What could our audience, anyone who might be watching, they could be brokers, they could be underwriters, they could be claims folks, legal professionals in different areas of claims. You know, what could they help you with?
Oh boy. Okay. Underwriters, please, could we rationalize the amount and type of questions that we ask of our clients? Could you please read the submission before you come to the underwriting call so that we can put a really, really prepared audience in front of our clients because they spend so much time preparing to come talk to you.
Great. All right. Well, you know, if anyone wants to get in touch with you, how should they do it?
I suppose LinkedIn. I don't know. Email?
Okay.
Carrier Pigeon? LinkedIn.
Email, LinkedIn. Hang around in EC3 in London and see if they see you.
Just walk around the city and we'll see each other. I'm really tall, so you can't miss me.
Great. All right. Well, it's a pleasure having you on the show, and thank you very much for your time. You know, it was really a pleasure.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
If you want to learn more about our host Anthony or his company Aceris, visit aceris.com, aceris.com. Thanks to our friends at Sawoo for producing this episode with us. See you next time.